MacCast, Sunday, May 29th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hey, got a good show for you today. We've got lots of stuff to cover. Looking like most people are consuming mobile video on iOS devices. We'll talk about that a little bit. Italy says there might be some problems with AppleCare, and rumors about new iPhones and potentially A5-powered MacBook Airs. So we've got that to look into. Also, more creative uses for Find My iPhone. Going to talk a little bit about the whole Mac Defender thing. Do we need to panic over viruses? Is it time to start installing virus checkers, or is it a little more benign than that? Also, a look at Omni Outliner versus Notebook and the differences and uses for those, along with some tips and tricks for GarageBand on the iPad. That and a whole lot more in this episode, so stay tuned. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Stitcher. They make an application called Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can use it to listen to the MacCast on the go, streaming, all without having to sync or download through iTunes, anything like that. If you go to Stitcher.com, that's STITCHER.com/MacCast right now, you can fill out the form, get an email reminder to go grab the application, or better yet, just go straight to the App Store, download the application, because it's completely free. And once you have it on your mobile phone or your iPad, they even have it for Android, so if you're on an Android device, grab it. You can subscribe to the MacCast or favorite the MacCast within the application. And then when new episodes are available, they'll be right there on your device ready to stream. Great if you're going to be traveling, if you're going to be away from your Mac and you can't sync up your podcasts, you can access them through this app. So you can get all kinds of podcasts, including some of the other ones that I'm on. We Have Communicators, Mac Roundtable, all your favorite programs right on demand. And it's not just podcasts. They also do traditional radio, so you can get access to hundreds of radio stations, either locally or around the globe, and it'll even use geolocation to find the stations in your area. And you can favorite all those things. You can set up lists. Now, it's not like a traditional podcatcher where you download this stuff. It can actually notify you when new episodes are available, and then you stream them. It's just like having a podcast radio station, a radio station with all of your podcasts, and they can go one right after the other. You can even mix and match them up. It is really great. And right now, not only can you get the app for free, but for a limited time, they're offering the chance to win an iPad 2 for new listeners. So go download the app, install it, and then use the code MACCAST when you sign up. During the registration process, it'll ask you for a promo code. Enter MACCAST, and you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad 2 just for downloading and trying out the app. So check it out, Stitcher.com, STITCHER.com/MACCAST, or just download the app from the App Store, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. So this week, an interesting study came out from a company called FreeWheel. Now, FreeWheel, what they do is they put ad placements in online videos for clients like Warner Brothers, AT&T, IGN, and they took a look at their Q1 numbers for 2011. They looked at over 10 million video views from the videos by their clients and found that on mobile devices, iOS accounted for about 80% of the views. The other 20% was Android, and then everybody else was negligible in terms of online distribution of video content to mobile devices. Now, even more interesting is on iOS devices, the breakdown seemed to be almost even. They had 30% on the iPhone, 30% on the iPod Touch, and 20% on the iPad. But what it kind of shows is that iOS has really become the platform of choice for getting video on mobile devices, at least when it comes to the web. I would imagine, though, that this also translates to how people are using their mobile devices just to consume content, maybe purchased through stores like iTunes or through Netflix, other streaming online services. We see a lot of apps that are delivering video now, like the ABC app. The HBO app was just released. I know some people are really loving that. I think Victor Cahiao mentioned that on the last episode of the MacCast. And so I find it really interesting how much the iOS devices have really changed how people are consuming entertainment, and how a lot of people in Hollywood, and I think even Steve Jobs at one point when he was saying there was never going to be video on the iPod, said no one wants to watch video on these tiny screens. Yet here we are now, few years later, and it's starting to become a preferred format for people to consume video. I know I'm watching more and more stuff, especially with Netflix, even on my iPhone, just because the iPhone size makes it really easy to lay in bed. Even my iPad can be a little bit wieldy sometimes. I kind of jump back and forth between the two, but I'm kind of curious if your video consumption and viewing has changed. I know there's been a lot of studies recently, too, that showing that iOS devices, both in terms of the games and the video content, are starting to compete with television. And a lot of people are supplementing their entertainment with the iOS platform and iPhones and iPods and stuff like that, or using those devices at the same time as they are watching traditional television entertainment. And we're really starting to see, I think, this convergence. There's a lot more talk about it. A lot of companies are experimenting with this stuff. And I think when Apple goes to launch some of the iCloud services, we're going to see a lot more focus on delivering not only music content. There's been a lot of discussion about the Music Locker service, and we're going to be getting into that in a bit. But video is definitely going to have to be a part of that more and more. And I think numbers like this, seeing the number of people that are consuming video on iOS devices only, is going to push that kind of drive forward for Apple to get some deals done and to start focusing more on TV and movie entertainment with respect to iOS. And then speaking on the music front, a lot more information coming out about Apple's deals with the record labels and the iCloud, the rumored iTunes Music Locker. Apple reportedly has closed deals this week with Sony, EMI, and Warner Brothers, meaning that as far as the major record labels go, they just have Universal to close, and it's sounding like they're getting close to that, at least according to the rumors. The one thing a lot of people are wondering and kind of got brought up this week is, how is what Apple doing any different than the services that Amazon and Google already launched? Both those companies have cloud-based music services, and a lot of people felt that they kind of beat Apple to the punch and maybe took a little wind out of their sails. Well, the record labels are kind of backing Apple, saying that because Apple's working with us, they're going to be able to offer more or offer a different type of service than you're seeing with Amazon and Google. But they never really went into detail. So there's been a couple of people looking at that this week. I think Jason O'Grady over at the Power Page wrote up a really nice piece about this. But basically, the big difference is that Amazon and Google require you to re-upload your music up into their storage locker. So basically, they're just giving you a backup service, almost like if you had a cloud-based backup. So that takes a long time. It has to go through your music library. It can go through iTunes and upload your non-DRM stuff, and you can push that into the cloud with Amazon and Google, but you have to wait for all of that to go up. And if you have a large music library, that's going to be kind of a pain, and some people have mentioned that in their reviews. Well, because Apple's doing deals with the record labels, reportedly with Apple's service, what they're going to be able to do is fingerprint the music in your iTunes library and then unlock that or give you access to that content that's already on Apple's servers. And even better still, they're saying now that if Apple finds that they have a higher quality version, so Apple servers have what they have in iTunes, which is basically now 256 kilobit AAC files, unprotected AAC files, they will be able to sort of upsample or give you a higher quality version of the tracks that you already have. And there's been some rumor, too, saying that the record labels will even allow you to unlock music that wasn't purchased through iTunes. So stuff you ripped yourself into your library. A lot of people have questioned whether they'll allow that because of the whole piracy issue. Maybe you didn't acquire that stuff quite legally, but there it is in your music library. I think Apple's argued successfully, and it kind of makes sense with the labels, that You know what? You're going to have to pay for this locker service. It's going to be an add-on service, or there's some rumors that it might be included with your Mobile Me subscription, sounding like possibly there'll be both plans. So if you pay $99 a year and you have Mobile Me, you'll be able to get access to this service, or you'll have some options to buy just the Music Locker service itself. But either way, Apple's going to be collecting a monthly fee for this service, or going to be collecting some fees for the service, and reportedly that will be shared with the record labels, and that's going to offset some of this cost. Very similar to what they do with subscription services. It really, when you think about it, it's not much different. So when I started hearing these reports, it made sense to me. You know, if you're paying $15 a month to get access to an entire catalog, and the music labels are getting a portion of that licensing fee, then it really doesn't matter where that music came from. You have access to it as long as you're paying that subscription service. And so if it's in your library, sounds like it'll be in your locker, and you're not going to have to re-upload it. So that's just one aspect of this. I would imagine there's some other things that Apple's going to be able to enable. I know the record labels are not happy with Amazon or Google. As far as when we might see the iTunes Locker Cloud Music Service, well, some people are saying we'll see it launched at WWDC. I think that's a little bit aggressive on the timing. I would imagine that we'll hear about it and possibly get announcement of a launch date. But a lot of the reports I'm reading say that even though Apple will probably have the deals in place with the record labels, they still have to sign up the publishers, and I would imagine that might take a little bit more time. So stay tuned. WWDC is right around the corner next week, as a matter of fact, and so we'll hopefully have some details about what Apple's been up to with the iCloud. If you live in Italy, it looks like regulators in your area might be trying to get you a little extra coverage on your AppleCare. 9to5Mac is reporting that regulators in Italy are currently investigating whether or not Apple's standard warranty coverage of 1 year goes against an EU consumer protection directive that would require 2 years minimum coverage. The report claims that Apple has been relying on local retailers being responsible to be in compliance with local laws and honor the 2 year warranty. Apple still in the region just sells the standard AppleCare, which is for 1 year. I find it interesting that they're saying they're relying on local retailers' responsibilities because, as far as I know, there are Apple stores in Italy. So what happens when you take your product back to an Apple store and you're past the 2 year coverage? Now, when I was looking into this, the story that I read didn't indicate what the EU law in question was, but I did a little bit of research, and I think what they're talking about is European Directive 1999/44/EC. Yeah, I know, very legalistic name, but in essence, what it boils down to is that a retailer can be held liable for what they call any non-conformities in a product which manifests themselves within 2 years of delivery. Now, I don't live in the EU, obviously, and I'm not a legal person, or I don't understand necessarily the legalese of warranty contracts, but I'm going to do my best, and if I get something wrong, let me know. But I think basically what it means is that the time you buy it, it's expected to meet certain requirements. And if it doesn't meet those requirements, if it doesn't conform to those requirements, then you can enable this 2 year warranty. You're covered for 2 years, which could be beyond what the manufacturing warranty that comes with the product. It's the non-conformities part, though, that I think gives Apple a little bit of wiggle room in this case. And another interesting thing about this is that any local laws, so this is an EU law, if a country has laws that provide more protection than this one, then those laws would supersede this directive. So in the case of, for example, England and Wales, we've talked about before, I think, the Sale of Goods Act in those countries, which basically covers consumers on products for up to 6 years. Now, when you start digging in, though, that's where a lot of stuff comes up to interpretation. So, with the Sale of Goods Act, it's my understanding it requires three things. One, the goods must be as they're described when they're sold to you. The other thing is that they have to be of satisfactory quality. And that, I guess, is determined by the description the manufacturer gives, the price, the durability, and the expectation that when it's sold to you, it's free from minor defects. And also that what they tell you you can use it for, you have to be able to use it for. If you use it in that way and then it breaks, then you should be covered by this. Now, it has to violate one of these rules for this protection to kick in. And I think that's the loophole. That's the part where it's really down to interpretation. I mean, what does the goods must be as described, or what is satisfactory quality? Your quality requirements might be very different than what Apple says their quality requirements are. And the device has to fail through no fault of your own, meaning that consumer damage obviously isn't covered. And I think that's pretty standard. But another part of this that's really up to interpretation is they also say it must be reasonable to expect the device or product to last longer. Now, what is reasonable? That's up to a lot of interpretation. So getting back to the EU law, what does non-conformity mean? I think so you're gonna have to argue that the device didn't conform to these sort of esoteric rules, and then at that point, your 2-year warranty coverage would kick in. Basically, that means what I think that means is that when Apple sold it to you, the product met the specifications and performed the way they said it would. And I think Apple would argue, well, yeah, when we sell you the product, it's going to perform the way we said it does, and it meets the specifications that we put on our little spec chart. And then, unless you can prove at the time of sale that Apple knowingly gave you something other than that, then you can enact your 2-year coverage. But you need to prove that they did it deliberately and knowingly, and that they misled you as to the quality of the product. And I don't know that anybody could argue that Apple really does that. I mean, we've had situations like the NVIDIA chips, Apple gets a bad batch. Well, when stuff like that happens, they enact a warranty extension program and they actually cover it. So Apple's internal policies and their warranty extension programs would likely cover you anyway outside of the warranty. And I would guess that they could argue that in good faith, they're already covering you within the bounds of the EU law in the cases where nonconformity happened. We have all these stories of Apple actually replacing items out of warranty when you come in. They could use that as prior examples of, hey, look, when we are in violation of what this EU directive says, then we actually take care of our customers. So we're already meeting and in compliance of the law. So it's going to be interesting to see what the commission finds. It's just an investigation at this point, so we'll kind of stay on top of it. And if you live in the region, let us know what's happening and shoot me an email. Could Apple have higher aspirations for its A5 processor beyond phones and tablets? Well, rumors this week from a Japanese blog, Makotakara, say that Apple has been playing around with the idea of putting an A5 processor in the MacBook Air. The site cites a source that says Apple is internally testing a version of the MacBook Air using the A5 processor. They didn't know if the device was actually running iOS or macOS 10, but they did say that they're finding performance is better than expected. Two challenges noted in the report is one, that Apple's having trouble getting Thunderbolt support working properly in the Finder in iOS, and that also making universal versions of applications that would operate on the A5 processor and the Intel processor under macOS 10 has become a bit of a challenge. As far as the performance goes, even though it's noted as being better than expected, the unofficial Apple weblog points out that even though the A5 is a great chip and has been getting a lot of rave reviews in iOS devices, it really is targeted at tablets and smartphones and really can't compete with the current generation of low-end notebook processors. As an example, they cite some of the Geekbench scores, which in the case of the A5 come in at about 720 or 720 points. If you look at the current low-end MacBook Air, it receives a score of 2000. Now, that's a significant difference in terms of a benchmark score. The Intel processor is scoring almost three times the or three times higher than the A5, but performance tweaking and tweaking for certain platforms might bring them a little bit closer together. Also, the operating system they're running would make a huge difference, whether or not it's running iOS or macOS 10, and Apple could tweak a little some things, but really, I don't think you're going to be able to close that gap very much. Another thing to think about is the fact that when you're upgrading notebook processors or notebook performance, you typically want to see that performance go up. As a matter of fact, a few weeks back, DigiTimes reported on a rumor that Apple was getting set to release a new version of the MacBook Air with Intel's Sandy Bridge processors and Thunderbolt ports, probably showing up around the June-July timeframe. That's the kind of bump up you're going to want to see. You're not going to want to see a drop down to something like the A5. That doesn't mean that Apple couldn't eventually put custom silicon on the MacBook Air, but it's probably not going to happen anytime in the near future. What's probably going on here is Apple is always playing around with different designs and different ideas. They're probably thinking that an iPad with an integrated keyboard might be something that consumers are interested in. And what we might be hearing rumors about is some sort of reference design of a hybrid style tablet targeted at people who are really heavy typists, reporters, bloggers, things like that. We know that there are cases out on the market. There already have been a lot of products that merge an iPad case along with an integrated Bluetooth keyboard, and so there's certainly some demand for that type of device. As far as the A5 processor itself goes, there were some rumors this week that Apple may be moving where those chips are made. Samsung currently provides the fabrication for the A5 processor, but there's some rumors saying that Apple's been eyeing another company, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Limited, as a potential new home for the chip. Intel also came out this week and said that they would be interested in doing some custom silicon foundry for some of their larger customers, I think with a big wink, wink, and nudge, nudge in Steve Jobs' direction, but doesn't sound like Apple's going to be moving to Intel for the A5, at least not according to the rumor mill. Intel also shot down the idea of Apple moving the MacBook Air to an A5 processor, saying that they work really closely with Apple on their notebook designs. They've had a great relationship and they've been churning out some really great products. And I think I would concur with that. If you look at the latest generation of MacBook Airs and the whole Sandy Bridge architecture and how that's built into the latest round of upgrades with the MacBooks and MacBook Pros, I think for sure Apple's going to be continuing with the Intel processor line at least in the near future. And it sounds like even if the day should come when Apple decides it wants to design its own notebook chips, that Intel is already kind of throwing its hat in the ring saying, hey, we'll help you build those products. And considering they have such a great relationship now, I would imagine that could continue in the future. But I wouldn't expect an A5 processor in any kind of Apple notebook, at least not anytime soon. It's kind of hard to be even talking about rumors this close to WWDC, but it's typically what we do. A lot of stuff spinning around in the rumor mill. This week was no exception. We heard a lot about iOS 5, iPhone 4s, and iPhone 5s. On the iOS 5 front, TechCrunch fed the rumor monster this week, saying that Apple will add widgets and a completely revamped notification system into iOS 5. On the widget front, I have to wonder if that's something that we really need on our phones. It's another thing that's going to be running in the background, maybe sucking up battery life. On the Mac, I have stuff in my dashboard, but I really don't use it. We know that dashboard is changing a little bit. In Lion, it's going to be kind of off to the left-hand side, so you'll be able to kind of get to it in a little bit of a different way. Maybe that'll make it a little bit more useful. And it makes sense that that might translate into the iOS device. So imagine swiping to the left, and along with the little search box, if you look there now, there's kind of a lot of space. You could have some widgets running in that area, and I would imagine that's what a lot of people are responding to. Have a little clock or a Twitter widget or some other stuff over off to that left side. And you could even potentially have multiple screens. I think somebody did a mock-up online this week. I think for sure something that needs some revamping is the notification system in iOS. It'd be nice to be able to go back through prior notifications, do something a little bit more like they've done in Android. Although I have to say, having an Android device, I'm not totally sold on that. And Android does have both widgets and kind of this more robust notification system where you can kind of get a history and more information about what happened. Another thing they're saying with respect to iOS 5 is that Apple is not going to move to their own mapping system. That had been a rumor that had been floating around. It sounds like they're going to continue to use Google Maps, just adding in some of the newer updated Google Maps features, which will be some nice additions. Apple still is hiring internal engineers for a potential new mapping system in iOS. If you remember, they acquired two companies, PlaySpace and Poly9, both focused on mapping technologies, and the whole thing with LocationGate, the location data that was being collected, Apple did come out and say that they were going to use that information for an upcoming mapping and traffic system. So Apple's definitely internally working on something, but it's sounding like it's not going to show up in iOS 5. The other thing we heard about iOS 5 this week that's going to make some consumers not very happy is that it's not going to be able to run on some older hardware, including the iPhone 3GS, at least according to one analyst. If that should happen, I have to say it wouldn't necessarily surprise me. Apple can only support hardware so far back. They got to keep moving forward and pushing the technology forward. I think Apple does a better job than Android in terms of supporting older devices and older hardware, although they typically go a couple generations back. And at this point, the iPhone 3GS is just one generation back from the iPhone 4. So I think it's a little bit more of a bitter pill for a lot of people to kind of come to grips with and to potentially swallow. Now, we don't know that it's official yet, so we're going to have to wait and see what Apple announces at WWDC. I would imagine they're going to show off iOS 5 and some of these details will likely be released. Although in the past, Apple has released a new version or shown off a new version of the operating system and not really mentioned the specific hardware requirements. It could be something they're still trying to iron out and figure out if there is a way to support back to older versions of the iPhone. It could be a situation too, like we had with the iPhone 3G, where they'll release the new OS and maybe some of the newer features aren't supported on the older hardware. As far as the hardware goes, what do we expect to see? Well, it's either going to be the iPhone 4S or the iPhone 5 as the next generation hardware. Most people are not expecting Apple to mention anything about a new iPhone at WWDC. If it is just a rev, that's what people are calling this sort of iPhone 4S, would be a minor revision, not really changing the design of the device itself, just doing an upgrade probably to the A5 processor, maybe a higher megapixel camera, something in the 8 megapixel range. And we did see some case designs reportedly showing that the flash would be moved away from the camera sensor over to the other side of the phone. The other rumor is that Apple would move to a true global cellular chip, enabling them to produce just one phone, unlike they have to do with the current iPhone 4 with a different version for the CDMA network and GSM networks, and also that Apple would be adding Sprint and T-Mobile as carriers in the US. But even if they did that, it's sounding like Apple's going to stick with the current 3G technology and not put out a phone that would support 4G, unless you're talking about the iPhone 5, according to the rumors. I think in a lot of cases, these rumors are getting mixed up and nobody really knows what Apple's up to. They're probably playing around with a lot of different designs, but let's talk about the iPhone 5 for a minute. So on the iPhone 5, they're saying global cellular chip supporting 4G technologies, the next generation LTE networks, still a bump up on the camera sensor to 8 megapixels. The more significant thing with an iPhone 5 update is that Apple would be changing the design a bit, going with a thinner design, possibly with a smaller Apple-designed SIM card to get the size down a little bit. This is based on statements made by the head of France Telecom, which is the parent company for Orange, one of the iPhone carriers in France. There's also rumors that Apple has purchased 200 or 300 glass cutting machines to give to their glass suppliers. The reason for that is that glass suppliers have been hesitant to create curved displays. This is a rumor that I really don't understand, but supposedly, according to some sources, Apple bought these really expensive glass cutting machines. They're going to be giving them to their manufacturers so they can have a curved display on the iPhone 5. I guess this is something that Samsung has built into the Nexus S, which is kind of a concave screen. According to Samsung, they say it improves usability. I don't know how that would make a difference, and also I would think that would pose some challenges in making the device thinner. If the screen concaves in, you're going to have less room for components inside. I mean, one of the reasons why the iPhone 4 is such a flat design is it'll enable Apple to do a really thin design but still have space for all the different components and chips and stuff they need to get in there. That smaller SIM card must be a lot smaller. As far as when we might see the actual hardware, rumors are still believing that it would be at the earliest sometime in the fall, maybe September. If Apple goes with a 4G chip, it might not even show up until early 2012. I think that for a lot of reasons is because of the chip technology. Apple has reportedly not been able to get anybody to produce a chip that kind of meets their stringent requirements in terms of power consumption, performance on 4G. And I think that, you know, major rollout of the 4G networks, I think AT&T announced that they're going to have 5 or 6 more cities with 4G online in 2011, but really there's not going to be a large rollout of 4G availability until sometime throughout 2012, maybe not even until 2013, till it really is a ubiquitous tech kind of technology. So I don't see any rush in Apple getting a 4G phone out, which lends more credence to me to the rumors that Apple would do an iPhone quote-unquote 4S. And once again, I think this naming is a little bit silly. I think if Apple does put out an iPhone in the fall, it's just going to be called the iPhone 5. And I think what's up for debate is whether it's going to be some sort of major revision or just a minor bump up. And I'm guessing that what we're going to see is not a lot of changes in the design, an A5 processor, and some of the other updates. We're talking about the global cellular chip, announcement of it being on Sprint and T-Mobile in the US. I think all that stuff's going to come to light. And most of the changes, I think, are going to come about in the software side of things. Something that is leading some of the rumor sites to say that Apple is going to show off the iPhone 5 at WWDC is apparently they've been prompting journalists in the UK to come over for the event. Again, I think this isn't because of a hardware announcement. I think it's because the iPhone team wants reporters covering what they're going to be talking about with respect to the operating system. I think WWDC is going to be all about macOS 10, 10.7, and iOS 5. I also think that Apple is going to be potentially announcing the iCloud stuff, and that would be a big thing for reporters to cover. And we've already heard some inklings that there's going to be some major technology upgrades in iOS 5. Things like better voice command and voice integration with the Nuance Dragon naturally speaking technology built in. And we've already seen some screenshots and some information about Nuance Voices being in iOS 5. So something is definitely happening on the voice front, and that could be a huge big announcement and something worth covering. I think it's probably worth the trip over the pond just for the operating system stuff. On the desktop front, it's sounding like Lion is getting very close to being completed. Some of the rumor sites are saying that Apple could potentially, even at WWDC, show off the operating system and announce availability that day. I'm not placing my bets on that happening, but I think we will hear a release date. Apple had said it was going to be out this summer, so should be very, very soon. Apple's reportedly released an internal testing build at Apple, which is typically one of the final stages before actually shipping the product. There's some major changes in Lion, including removing some key technologies. It came out this week that iSync is no longer in there. I don't know that anybody's really gonna miss iSync. I don't think anybody really uses that anymore. Maybe there's some sort of older software and stuff that still relies on iSync, but I think Apple's really moved to a different syncing system for OS X. One thing that I heard is being removed that I think a lot of people are going to be upset about, especially people who are using Macs as home media centers, and older Mac Minis and things like that, said that Front Row is no longer in Lion. Also, we know that Java is not going to be bundled in, that you're going to have to grab that from Sun, but that should be a relatively easy install. I think I even heard that if you launch an application that requires Java, it'll pop up and actually go out to Sun servers and download that automatically. A bigger one that some people are going to be upset about and likely miss is Rosetta support. So if you have older applications, Office 2004, for example, that's likely not going to run under Lion. So that could be a pretty costly upgrade. You're going to have to pay for the operating system and then probably pay for a lot of your older applications to be upgraded if you haven't done that yet. I really don't blame Apple for deciding that it's time to move on. If an application isn't OS X native at this point, it's probably time for it to be. It's been, what, 5-6 years since the operating system was released. So I think that's a reasonable time frame. But still, it's going to sting for a lot of people when they have to upgrade things like Office and Quicken and stuff like that. It's going to break some stuff and it is going to be a pain and just something to be aware of. And you're going to have to consider if you've been considering an upgrade to Mac OS X Lion. So a little bit of bad news for Rosetta users, but if you are a terminal geek, something was discovered this week that might make you excited about the upgrade to Lion. A couple little terminal tweaks. Not major things, but nice little adjustments. You can now adjust the background blur in your transparent terminal windows. Also, the terminal now has true full screen support through Lion's built-in full screen mode, so you can get a nice big terminal window opened up. And then the full screen mode in Lion supports a four-finger gesture on the trackpad, which will allow you to jump between that full screen app and your window desktop. So you can simply switch back and forth. You can have your big full screen terminal window up and running and doing all your command line stuff. And that's going to be a nice little welcome tweak for those of us who have to live in terminal from time to time. So looking forward to seeing what Apple has up its sleeve in terms of all of its operating systems, both iOS, or both of them, I guess I should say, iOS and Mac OS X. And we should hear more about that coming up next week. And then finally today, in case you didn't know it, Apple and Samsung have been working together to build iOS devices. Samsung provides a lot of the technology that goes into making iPads and iPhones, but there has been a lawsuit going on. Apple's felt that Samsung borrowed a little bit too much from its designs when it manufactured its latest tablets and smartphones. So Apple had actually filed a motion in a California court to get Samsung to have to provide samples of some of their upcoming products that actually was ordered by a judge. So Samsung has to turn over their Galaxy 2S, Galaxy Tab 8.9, Galaxy Tab 10.1, Infuse 4G, and 4G LTE Droid Charge designs to Apple to take a look at so that they can do some expedited discovery to provide for their case. Well, Apple Insider reports this week that Samsung is kind of having this feeling of, well, if I show you mine, you have to show me yours. And so they filed a counter motion or a countersuit asking a judge to require Apple to give up their upcoming designs. Now, the difference is that Samsung had already announced the products that Apple asked to see. Apple typically doesn't pre-announce products, but Samsung is citing rumors of the iPhone 4S and iPhone 5 designs and Apple's past behavior, saying that we know Apple is working on prototypes and we want to have a look at them. They claim that Apple, they need to see Apple's future products in order to prepare for their case. So we'll have to see if a judge agrees with that. And if they do, we might get verification that there is an iPhone 4S or iPhone 5, which is probably something Apple doesn't want to have happen. So they're probably going to fight it pretty good. All of this is a little bit strange to me, but I guess this is the way it goes in the tech world nowadays. A lot of times your partners are also end up being your enemies or the people that you file lawsuits against at the very least. Apple is actually Samsung's second largest customer. As a matter of fact, in 2010, Samsung had $142 billion in revenue, and Apple accounted for about 4% of that. So that's not chump change. That's not a small amount. And I guess you just kind of keep this stuff separated in business now. Just kind of the name of the game. But still, when you read about it, it's a little bit strange. And that's going to do it for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment, thank another one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. It's a great application if you need to take notes, if you need to do any kind of planning, you need to do any kind of research. Notebook is a perfect application for that because it basically simulates a real-world notebook. You can gather stuff together. You can put in different sections. You can add in dividers. You can throw on flags and sticky notes to help you quickly find things. When you put information into Notebook also, it automatically gets indexed by their multi-dex. So it's sequenced and kind of put together in multiple ways. You can search on just where you have URLs, links back to other information, and that information can be thrown in via web clippings, which is a nice feature. You can define sections and pages, and you can be reading an article in another application, and through macOS 10's built-in services, automatically clip that and throw that right into your notebook in the background. Continue browsing through the web or searching through your RSS feeds, knowing that all of that information is over in Notebook. And when you come back to it, you need to re-reference it. It'll all be there. And then you can start to organize it and move it around and things like that. And it goes beyond just note-taking. You can do voice annotations. You can throw in images and graphics and text. You can even draw your own stuff on top of your documents. So if you want to add in a PDF and do some annotation, draw some charts, circle some things, you can do that all with the built-in tools, and it keeps it all together. So it's great for projects because, once again, you can have different sections and you can have areas and stuff for different types of information and keep it all together. So you can create different notebooks for different purposes and different projects, classes, and things like that. If you're a student, it's really great for all those different applications. Basically, anything that you would use a physical notebook for, you can do virtually with Circus Pony's Notebook. It's got a great design and layout. You can check out more information and details, see screenshots, get tutorials over on their website. You can also download a free trial so you can try before you buy and get all of the information. Just head to circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Now, on an episode of the MacCast, I think it was two episodes ago, I mentioned that I had a listener who was using Find My iPhone in a very creative way, in a way that wasn't just to find or locate a stolen or lost iPhone. He was actually using it to help his girlfriend, who was doing a ride through the UK to raise money for a charity, and he was the support vehicle, and he was using that for tracking. Well, I got some feedback from Phil, where he's using it in a very similar but also creative way.
Hi, Adam. This is Phil from Pittsburgh. First off, thanks for the advice on the voice control software. I think we'll be switching my dad over to a Mac this summer for his birthday, so really appreciate that. Second, I was listening to the latest MacCast and listening to when you were discussing about the gentleman who was following his girlfriend and her fundraising efforts and cycling across England, and reminded me of another interesting way to use Find My iPhone. Last weekend, my wife ran her first solo half marathon in the Pittsburgh Marathon, and I used it to track her progress across the route so that I could make sure that we met her at different places and knew when to cheer for her when she would go by. There's a lot of runners who would go by at any given time, so you could very easily miss the person and second guess, gosh, have they already gone by or not. So Find My iPhone was perfect to know exactly when we should be paying attention to look for her. So it worked out really well for that. And she's used it to track me in some of the longer distance trail runs I've used. And it's really handy there because on the trails, you never know where your pace is going to pick up or slow down as you navigate the trails. And so she was able to use it to track me to know exactly when to catch up with me at the different checkpoints on the trail races. So another interesting way to use Find My iPhone, pretty handy little application. I know we really like it. So thanks a lot for the great show, Adam. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks, Phil. Yep. Perfect application for Find My iPhone. I think there's a lot of people that are using it to do this sort of thing. I would imagine also, although I haven't heard too much about it, that it can also come in handy for safety reasons. If you have someone who's maybe in a remote area, they're off hiking or something like that, and they ever get lost, you could potentially use Find My iPhone to actually track them down and potentially rescue them. I'm surprised we haven't heard more stories like that. I also think that maybe there's some parents out there who are probably using it to keep track of their kids and figure out where they are and make sure they are where they said they were going to be when they're supposed to be there. So, it sounds a little Big Brother-ish, but I think if you're up front and tell your kids, hey, we're going to be tracking you through Find My iPhone, I don't see any reason not to use it. It's great technology, and that could be a perfect application. Another one that I think that people don't think about with respect to Find My iPhone is how many of us have lost our iPhones in our own house. So you go on Find My iPhone and you can get that peace of mind that, oh, you know what, I didn't leave it at the coffee shop. It's actually here in my house. And even better yet, it has that option where you can send an audio alert to the device. And even if it's in silent mode, it'll start beeping. So it can help you actually locate it within your own house. And I know a couple people have used that feature and it works really well. I've tried it out. I've never actually lost my phone in my own house, I have to admit, but I have tested out the feature before and it does work remarkably well. And the sound is really annoying too. If you've never heard it, you can just even play around with it. You'll be able to find that device, believe me, because it's pretty loud and pretty annoying and it doesn't stop. It just keeps playing and playing and playing until you find the device. So I think it goes like 2 minutes or something like that. Received an email from David, and he needs some help from the community. David recently was working with some PDF files. I think he received them at work, and he uses Preview, like a lot of us do, to just quickly read and open PDF files. And when he opened this particular document, it didn't have all of the information, or actually in this case had extra information that he wasn't supposed to be seeing. And the reason was apparently that Preview and applications like PDF Pen Pro don't support PDF layers, which I guess is something that's supported by Adobe's Acrobat Reader. I went ahead and tested this feature out myself with a PDF. I opened up Illustrator, created a couple of different layers, then hid one of those layers and generated an Adobe PDF. And when I opened it up in Preview, what happened was it renders all of the layers as visible, even though one of them was marked as invisible when I actually did the exporting. Layers are a feature that's been supported in Acrobat since version 6, and in version 9, I guess they actually added the ability to create layers using Acrobat. So whoever had sent him this document had created these layers and had some of them hidden, so it wasn't rendering properly when he actually went to open it in Preview. It actually opened it, but it just was the incorrect information. So what he was wondering was, is there any way to get Preview to actually support the layering? My guess is that the answer is no, that you're going to have to use Acrobat Reader if you want to open up layered PDF files that have hidden layers in them and actually get them to see, actually get them to render properly on the Mac. But Acrobat Reader is a free download. Might not be the thing you want to use, but you can go ahead and grab it. And definitely Preview doesn't seem to support turning on or off those invisible layers. But I don't know, David, the MacCast community is pretty smart and they usually find ways around things. So I'm going to throw it out to you. If you have an answer for David, please send me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and I'll try and get that passed along to him so that he can do that. Maybe there's some little trick, some preference hack, something like that, I guess is what we're looking for. And now, boys and girls, it's time again to have the talk. I know we've had the talk before. The talk about safe Mac practices. The reason I'm bringing this up is, you know, we talked about it on the last show, and it's been ongoing in the news for a couple weeks now, this whole thing with the Mac Defender Trojan. And I got to be careful about what we call this. It is a Trojan and not a virus, and all of its variants, and why this really is nothing new. And we probably should first describe the difference between a Trojan and a virus, because you're going to hear a lot of people saying that, quote unquote, the Mac has viruses now. Well, this is not technically a virus. It's not something that's in the wild. And the difference is that a virus is something that is passed, you get on your system, and then it is automatically passed on to another system. A Trojan is something that somebody tricks you into downloading and installing on your Mac, and it might be passed along, but the person still has to download it and install it. It requires action to actually, on the part of the user, to actually do anything to your system. And this stuff is really nothing new. You know, it's a scam designed to get you to install something and then steal your information or get you to give up information by tricking you. And these types of things have been happening on the PC for a long time. The thing is that it can't take your data if you don't provide it. So the protection against this is really not anything technical. It's more an educational thing. It's being aware, and we've talked about this before. This is why we're having this talk again. It's being aware of what's going on in your system and making sure that you don't do, I'm not even going to call it dumb things, because anybody can be tricked with the right wording and the right way of doing things. We can be tricked. We're human beings. So it's just, we end up doing something silly. And it could be one of those oops moments, and we don't really mean to do it, but we don't need to panic about it. And if we are aware of this stuff and we get to be a little bit leery or a little bit more cautious about what's going on, I think that in the end, all becomes a good thing. Now, there was some concern because this Mac Defender thing came out, and I guess I should describe it for anybody who doesn't know. What happens is you'll be surfing the web, you'll be someplace, and it'll pop up and say, we've detected a virus on your Mac. Download this free software and we will protect you. And it's that downloading of the free software and installing it that you end up getting this malware. And I think in the case of Mac Defender, what happens is it keeps popping up and asking for your credit card information to buy software to, quote unquote, remove this virus or remove viruses from your Mac. Well, don't do it. Don't download it. Don't install it. It's just, you know, trying to trick you into getting your information. But there was a variant that came out. So Mac Defender came out, and then it was quickly caught and people were made aware of it. And then there were some variations that came out, and a lot of people were concerned because a variant came out that said it didn't require your password. The first version actually required your admin password to actually install. A new version came out that didn't require your password to launch or start the installer, but you still had to go through the action of actually saying, yes, I want to install this on my system. Well, actually, how does it do that? Because I think a lot of people have always heard, well, you know, everything requires your password. Well, that's not technically true. If it doesn't install anything into the system level applications folder, then there is a way for an installer to get out of the process of asking for your admin password. So if it installs into the applications folder within your user folder, and this is one of the reasons why one of the security measures we often recommend is that you don't run an admin account, that you run a user level account. Because if you do get your user level account sort of hacked or a virus gets in there, it's kind of sandboxed off. It can't get outside of that without asking for heightened permissions, without asking for an admin password to be entered. And so the second variant didn't require that admin password. But once again, it still was going to pop up an installer and say, do you want to install this software? And you have to click through the buttons and say, okay, yes, please install this on my system. And don't do that. That's the safe practices. So this is something that is not new in the computing world. It's been around for years. To put it in a little bit of perspective, though, this is the first time we've seen this kind of attack on the Mac. Microsoft themselves recently pointed out that 1 in 14 downloads on Windows, applications that are downloaded and installed by their users, are malicious applications. So far more prevalent, but by the sheer fact that this is the first time it's shown up on the Mac, and then we immediately saw a bunch of variants, I think it shows that the floodgates are now open. There are people who are interested in targeting Mac users, and it's people that are the security hole. It's not technology in this case. So they're just keying in on the fact that more people are buying Macs, there's more users in the Mac community, and they're targeting people. And those people happen to be using Mac computers. So how do you protect yourselves? Well, there's a couple different ways, a couple different things that you can do. The very first one is if you're using Safari, and I don't know why Apple doesn't change this default behavior, but go into the Safari preferences and uncheck the option that says open safe files after downloading. So you know that variant that I told you about that doesn't require the password? Well, the installer can automatically open up and prompt you because after you download with Safari, if you have open safe files after downloading, it will open up the installer file and start the install process. If you uncheck that, you're not even going to get prompted to install the software, and that may prevent you from doing something silly like clicking OK when it says, do you want to install this? Another one that a lot of people don't think about is disable Java. Now, this particular Trojan didn't leverage Java, but Java is something that can run inside the browser, and it can do certain things if you give it permissions. Well, if you don't have a specific need for using Java on your Mac, you probably want to go into Safari and just disable Java from running at all. And this is another reason why, mentioned earlier in Lion, Apple is not going to bundle in Java. Because if you don't need it, you don't need to have it running on your system, and it's just another thing where it's a potential attack vector for someone to go in. I'm not saying that Java is unsafe, because it is pretty safe if you know what you're doing when you use it, but for those of us who don't need it, it's just another layer we don't need to have running on our system. Another one that, again, I don't know why Apple doesn't have this on, but by default, but the status bar in Safari, because one of the tricks that a lot of attackers will use is they'll bring you to a website, or they'll send you an email, and it has a bad or malicious link in it going to a malicious website. Well, if you just look at the URL, you can often tell that, hey, this is not a legit thing. So you might get an email, say a phishing scam, that looks like a very legitimate email. And there's been some recently that look like emails from Apple, from the Apple store. But if you were to look at the actual link, you would see that it's not going to any site that by any shape or form is an Apple website. You would know immediately if you looked at the URL. But in Safari, for whatever reason, Apple turns off the status bar. And the status bar is the thing that when you hover over a link, you can actually see the full URL down there at the bottom of the window. So make sure you go in and you turn the status bar on and do it from the menu in Safari. Turn on the status bar so you can see that. And if you're in OS X Mail, if you just hover over a link, it will pop down a tooltip and it'll show you the link. So before you click, think before you click. And this is a good rule all the way around. If something pops up and says, do you want to install this? Read it. Don't just do the, you know, oh, click OK, because it's really annoying. That's how you do the silly thing. And that's how you get in trouble. And that's how in a lot of cases, people get this stuff. Another one that's pretty straightforward, keep your operating system up to date. Install your software updates. Apple actually provided information recently on how to remove Mac Defender and all of its variants in a tech support article, but they also said in that they're going to deliver a software update to automatically find and remove the Mac Defender malware and all of its known variants. It's going to be part of a security patch, and actually it came out this week that Apple released a new build of 10.6.8, the next update to Snow Leopard, and specifically noted in there was the fact that they are going to find and remove any of the Mac Defender stuff. So if you just keep your operating system up to date, it's going to keep you better protected, and Apple will actually, in this case, scan and remove the bad malware that you don't want on your system. So those are just some general tips. You know, be aware of what's going on your Mac, know what's going on, and share this information with your friends. Make sure that your friends and family members know not to do this sort of stuff, and that's going to keep us all better protected. But more and more these days, you know, hackers, they're not doing the virus thing anymore. What they're doing is they want to get information, because that's a lot more valuable. That's the kind of thing that makes them money. Selling credit cards, selling your personal data, getting your personal information. And they're going to use tricks, these old school scams that have been around in all kinds of forms for years. They're just perpetrating them electronically now. But it's the same old stuff, getting you to do something that you shouldn't be doing. So watch out for that sort of stuff and don't get caught. And just as an aside, I mentioned that 10.6.8 is out. In the release notes for that, something else of significance that you might want to be aware of is there was a note in there saying that part of the update was to get the Mac App Store ready for OS X Lion. Now, there's been some rumors that Lion might be delivered via the Mac App Store, and this is just further evidence that that actually might happen. I think Apple still will have a retail box. I'm still curious if they deliver it electronically, how they're going to provide a mechanism for doing a clean install, getting a boot disk. I'm hoping maybe that part of Lion will include the ability to generate your own either boot disk, or even better yet, it'd be great if you could generate a boot USB drive. So if you could take a USB key, throw that into your Mac, I would imagine it'd need to be of a significant size, probably a couple gigabytes, but say a 2 gigabyte flash drive, throw that in there, and Lion would write out an operating system, and you could actually boot from that to do a clean install. That would be pretty cool. So who knows if that's going to happen or not. That's just my speculation. But if Apple does deliver it electronically through the Mac App Store, they're going to have to provide some sort of mechanism, or you'll just be able to buy, as an alternative, a retail box copy from your local Apple retail store or online. I don't know. But just interesting note in 10.6.8. I don't know if you're familiar with the application Omni Outliner, but it's a great outlining application for Mac OS X. They just recently came out with their iPad version that a lot of people had been really waiting for. I'm an Omni Outliner user. I'm also a notebook user. You know that Circus Ponies is a sponsor of the MacCast, but I've been using notebook for years before that. And I actually use both products, and I had some emails and some questions recently asking if I would compare the two different applications, specifically on the iPad. But I thought I'd talk about the two applications and sort of what each one is. And you know, there's a slight overlap in the two applications, but I really view them as two separate applications. I really don't think they compete. As I mentioned, I use both, and I use them kind of for different applications depending upon what I need to be doing. So Omni Outliner really is truly a pure outlining application. You can do things like attach documents and images and stuff like that, but they really are just attachments to your outline. There aren't really any drawing tools. There's not really any concept of dividing it out into pages or sections and stuff like that. It's focused mainly on the text and doing core pure outlines, kind of a single page document. And if you want to create a new outline, you create a new document. Notebook, on the other hand, functions more like a traditional notebook, something that you would have on your desk, like a three-ring binder with multiple pages and sections, dividers. It's got tabs. You can throw on sticky notes and flags and stuff like that. There's a lot of other layers that you can put on top of your content. So you can add in drawing layers. They have all kinds of drawing tools if you want to do annotation. It has a table of contents. It has an index with their multi-dex feature to make it searchable through all different kinds of parameters. So if you want to find all the places where you have capitalized letters, you know, you can find that in the index that's automatically created. It has this concept of web clippings for using the built-in services in Mac OS X to throw in snippets from other applications. You also have the ability to drop in a PDF and have it not just be a link or an attachment, but it can actually embed the PDF pages right within your notebook document, and then you can layer on top of that all kinds of annotations. So you can really keep everything organized in kind of a single document, and it can have content from multiple different sources, not just an outline. Of course, you can build an outline within notebook, and you can have an outline page. You can also have notes pages that are just pure text and stuff like that. So really kind of two different applications. Now, one thing that's really cool is both applications support the OPML format for outlines, which is like a standardized format. So they can both import and export OPML outlines, so you can move content back and forth between the two applications. So very often I'll start out building an outline purely an Omni Outliner because I like that as an outlining application. And then I can take that and I can export that OPML file, import it into my notebook, and then use that as a section in my notebook, and then start building out other information. So if I'm doing a research project, or I'm doing a larger thing where I want to combine different documents and different information, I might later bring that in a notebook and handle that way. On the MacCast, I kind of do the opposite almost, because I really like the web clipping feature in notebook for doing research. I think I've mentioned this before. I have a notebook and I have different sections for Apple, for Mac OS X, for iOS, and I can clip stuff as I find it. As I'm working in my RSS reader application, or I'm working in Safari, I can clip stuff off in a notebook, and then I can start to pull out stuff and build out my outline, and then I can take that outline page, just that page out of notebook, export that out, and then bring that into Omni Outliner, and then finish up my notes. That's the notes that I use right now when I'm reading through to record the show. And then also that's what I use. I use Omni has a neat dynamic HTML export option that if you've ever been to maccast.com and looked at the show notes, you'll see that you can expand out the different sections. That's all written in some JavaScript code that actually gets exported as part of the dynamic HTML export feature of Omni Outliner. And that was something that I used early on in the Maccast, and I didn't want to change that format. So I always finish up and the outline ends up in Omni Outliner, but I really flip back and forth between the two applications. And like I said, they're kind of different and distinct applications. And that distinction actually translates over to the iPad applications as well. Very similar situation. Omni Outliner is really purely about doing outlines, whereas Notebook kind of has a lot more functionality built into it. It's a lot more robust in terms of the types of things that you can do with it. That's not to say that Omni Outliner isn't an incredibly powerful and full-featured application. It's just more focused on a specific task, whereas Notebook really can take you a lot further in terms of its flexibility. So you could use it just for, say, writing a book. If you wanted to write a whole book, you could do that in Notebook, whereas you're probably not going to want to do that in Omni Outliner. You could, but Omni Outliner is really not geared for that. It's geared for creating an outline. Now, one thing on the iPad that I think both products lack is Dropbox support. It's something I'd like to see added. Omni Outliner does have support for WebDAV, so you can integrate that with your iDisk, for example, or another WebDAV server. And I know there is that service that allows you to connect to your Dropbox like a WebDAV server. I think it's called DropDAV. So it's a separate service that you can purchase, and it layers on top of Dropbox and gives you WebDAV access to your Dropbox directories or your Dropbox folder. So that could be a way to go, but right now I think it's something that Omni is working on or wants to add into the product. I'm not sure what's happening on the Notebook side. One thing that is nice with both products is they support their native formats in transferring documents from the desktop applications to the iOS applications. So you can move your files back and forth through iTunes, and you can access the information that way. So I like both products. I use both of them. I've been playing around with Omni Outliner on the iPad, and I have to say it's really nice. Definitely a 1.0 version. There's some features that they're working on that aren't quite in there yet, but still, right out of the box, I think it's $19.99. I would definitely pick it up. If you're an Omni Outliner fan, you're going to love Omni Outliner on the iPad. It performs really well and has the core features that you'd really expect to be there. So I would recommend it very highly. And of course, I recommend Circus Pony's Notebook. You've heard me talk about it on the show before. So both great products and really different uses. So I hope that helps explain kind of how I use them and maybe what some of the differences and similarities are. Bob emailed me recently to let me know that he was having some trouble with his iMac not wanting to stay asleep, and he spent a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what was going on, thinking that there was a problem with macOS 10. Essentially, he told me what was happening is intermittently it would wake up at night, even though he double and triple and quadruple checked the settings in the energy saver. And I think we've all been there on this one, where the Mac starts acting strangely, and we think we know what the problem is, but every time we look, it seems like we've done everything right. We've got the settings right. The one thing I would have emailed back to him is, oh, you got to make sure that the wake for network access option is not turned on. But he had already taken care of that. He'd gone in and deselected the wake for network access option in the energy saver preferences. And luckily, he has figured out the answer. Because I like this type of email, because I don't have to do any of the research. Turns out what was going on is he had installed on his system Log Me In. And in case you don't know what Log Me In is, it's a great application and service that gives you remote access, kind of like Back to My Mac. It allows you to remotely log in and control your Mac. And they have I really like their solution for the iPad. It makes it really easy, and you just install it on your desktop. They have a free version. The application itself, I believe on iOS, is $14.99. Don't quote me on that price. I'm trying to go off of memory. But if you buy that, you can get access to the service for free. The problem is that the LogMeIn software is, in my opinion, a little bit more aggressive than most other applications in terms of what it puts on your system. It kind of has to layer some things at a lower level. And what Bob discovered was that it had its own wake on LAN setting within the software itself, and that was actually overriding anything that was in the system preferences. So you had to go into the LogMeIn preferences under advanced, and then you'll see the enable wake on LAN option. If that is checked, then it's overriding macOS 10's settings, and that was what was causing Bob's iMac to keep waking up, even though he had double checked the settings in Energy Saver. That's a little bit, I think, and Bob mentioned this, and I would agree with him, that's a little bit of a UI problem. I think that it shouldn't be allowed that a third-party application can go in and override a system-level setting. But apparently it is possible, and in a lot of ways it makes sense. LogMeIn is not going to work very well if it can't wake up your system when it's asleep. It needs to be able to wake that up when it gets the LAN request from your remote access so that you can actually remote access the system. It's not going to work otherwise. So I understand why they did it, but it definitely can be very confusing because you're looking in the area where you would think you'd need to look and everything seems to be set fine. So unless you know that it's some third-party application, and really how are you going to know that other than remembering? So Bob did mention that disabling that did fix his issue, but I think it serves as a good reminder that when troubleshooting our systems, if your Mac had been fine and performing just fine, and then suddenly you start to get odd behavior and you can't figure out why, if you've gone through all the system level stuff, try and remember exactly what you've changed on your system recently. What have you installed recently that may be impacting or affecting what's going on your system, and start to go down those paths, and you're likely to find the solution as Bob did. So Bob, thanks for reminding us about that and sending in your email. If you've been listening to the MacCast for any period of time, you probably know that I record this show using GarageBand, and I was very excited when Apple announced GarageBand for the iPad. I think I haven't had a chance to use it yet, but I might actually coming up here pretty soon to record a podcast. But I was excited about the thought that I could take a portable mic, I could use my USB camera connection kit from Apple and plug in an external microphone and probably do a pretty good podcast right from my iPad. Well, Mick has been playing around with that, and he sent me an email because he was having a problem where he couldn't seem to record more than 15 minutes of audio using GarageBand for the iPad. And I had heard some complaints about this. I actually, even the first time I tried GarageBand on the iPad, I had this exact same problem. It's not very intuitive in terms of how you set up a variable recording time. Sort of the way it's set up out of the box when you start up a new GarageBand project on the iPad is it defaults to having sections. And each section in a recording when you're in the timeline is set to an 8-bar section. And I think the idea is that for musicians, you'd build out little 8-bar segments and you can keep adding additional sections and sort of build up your song. Well, that doesn't really work if you're recording a podcast because you just want to record, you know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour of audio straight, and that's what you're going to be working with. Also, when you set up a new project, and this is the same way on the desktop, it sets a default tempo, and the default tempo is 110 beats per minute. So you have 8-bar sections at 110 beats per minute when you set up your new project. And then as you're working, you go into the song section area and you add additional sections, and you can actually adjust the length of the sections too. They start out at 8 bars, but you can make them up to 32 bars. And in our case, what we would really like to have happen is that the timeline continues to grow as we add more and more recording information. And luckily you can do that. It's just not really obvious how you do that. So what you need to do is you need to go into your GarageBand project, you need to go into the timeline mode, and then you need to click on the song sections button. And I think it doesn't help that Apple made the icon for this a little bit confusing. If you look up in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see a little puzzle piece icon. That is the song sections button. So you click on that, and then from there you can change the length of your section. You can also add additional sections. But if you've just started up a new project, you probably only have one. It's probably section A. So you click on section A, and then you toggle the little slider for the automatics option from off to on. And by turning that on, then what will happen is as you're recording, your song will automatically grow. So if you go back into the timeline and start recording, it's going to extend until you stop the recording. But even there is a limit. And I didn't know about this until Mick had sent me this email, because apparently there's a total limit in GarageBand on the iPad of 320 bars. So if you had the maximum length sections, which are 32 bars, you can add 10 sections. And actually, there's just a hard limit of 10 sections. So if you were doing the thing where you manually were adding sections, you can only add 10 of them. So if you had them at 8 bars, your total recording time is going to be even slower. And then you also need to realize that you factor in tempo to determine your total recording time based on the number of bars and the number of sections. So I'm not sure exactly how the math worked out in your case, Mick, but you mentioned you were getting a 15-minute limit and you were having to record your 45-minute podcast in 3 sections. Well, that has to do with all of these numbers. And you can do a little bit of the math. There's actually an Apple tech support article. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com that goes into all these details. But once again, it's not really stated up front, or it's not really obvious when you start using GarageBand for the iPad. So this is the way the math works out. We have 320 bars total that we know we can add to a timeline. If you take 4 beats per bar and then divide that by your tempo, in this case, say the default is 110 beats per minute, you end up with a total recording time of 11.6 minutes. So that's if you just flipped the slider to automatic and then recorded as long as you could on a default project at 110 beats per minute, you're going to get 11.6 minutes of recording time. So if you need to have longer than that, what you need to do is lower your beats per minute. So say we adjust those all the way down to its lowest setting, which in GarageBand is 40 beats per minute. That's going to give you a total recording time doing this math of 32 minutes. That's the absolute max recording time right now that you can do on GarageBand on the iPad. Those of us who've been using GarageBand on the Mac for a while probably remember that when the original version came out, it had a 999 bar limit, which if you were recording at 110 beats per minute gave you a 36 minute total recording time. And many of us hit that limit. I remember the first time I hit it and I didn't really understand what was going on. And then I realized if I just adjusted my tempo down, I could record a lot longer, up over an hour. So really makes a difference how you have your beats per minute set. So to change those on GarageBand on the iPad, you have to go into the song settings, and that's the little wrench icon. When you're in the timeline, click on the wrench icon and you'll see the tempo. You can just hit the down arrow and adjust that down to 40 beats per minute. Now, you need to make sure you do that before you start recording. Otherwise, it's going to actually slow down your voice track, and that will affect the sound of your voice. You're going to sound all slow and low and stuff like that. So you want to make sure that you set all of this stuff up beforehand. So start your new project, adjust the beats per minute down to 40 beats per minute, and then make sure you go into the song sections area and set it to automatic. And once you've done that, you should be able to record 32 minutes at a stretch. That's not going to get you up to your 40, 45 minutes that you say your podcast length is, but maybe you can talk a little bit quicker and get the job done, or divide it into 2 parts instead of 3. So I hope that helps you out, and that's what's going on there with GarageBand for the iPad. And then finally today, I have a question from Nick. Nick wanted to know if there was any way to change the default button that's selected in a dialog box that comes up. Specifically, he's like us, he listens to podcasts, and like also many of us, what we do is we go through iTunes every once in a while and we want to get rid of some old podcasts. We want to delete the files out of iTunes. And when you use that button there, a dialog box comes up and it asks you, what do you want to do? Do you want to keep this file or do you want to delete it? And the default option in that dialog box is to keep the file, which is a little bit strange because if you're deleting it, you actually want to, you figure most people are going to want to get rid of that file. So Nick wanted to change the default behavior of that dialog box. Well, you can't really change that. That's kind of set by the system. It's set by the application. But what you can do, Nick, is you can use some quick keyboard commands to actually control that dialog box or actually click the button rather than having to use your mouse, which gets a little bit tedious, especially if you're deleting a bunch of different podcasts. So first thing you need to know is that most of your standard Finder commands are going to work in that dialog box. This is actually particularly useful, not in this case, but say you have an open save dialog box that you've brought up. You can do things like press Command Shift N, which is the keyboard shortcut in the Finder for creating a new folder. You can use that to create a new folder that you may want to save a document into right from the dialog window. Also, if you want to cancel out of that window, rather than having to move the mouse over and click the cancel button, you can type Command Period, the keyboard shortcut for cancel in most cases, and that will close out the dialog box without doing anything. Another thing you should know is that generally in dialog boxes, typing the first letter of the name of a button will activate it. So this is useful in your case when you want to select the delete file button rather than the keep file button. If you just press the D key, it's going to hit that delete file button. So you can activate that automatically. So hit that rather than hitting return and accepting the default option, and that will actually delete your file. You can also just type the C key if you want to cancel that dialog box. Now, the one time that this doesn't work is if you have a dialog box where the first letter for both buttons is the same. In that case, what you probably want to do is use the keyboard commands to toggle the selected button. So if you look up at your buttons, you'll notice that the cancel button typically in this dialog box has a little blue highlight around it. That means that's kind of the selected button. It's not the default button. The default button was the one that's lit up in the color blue, and that's the one that's going to activate if you just hit enter on your keyboard. But the selected button, if you tap the space bar, that's basically like clicking whatever button happens to be activated by that selection. So hitting the space bar is actually going to cancel out of the window. If you just hit the tab key, you'll notice that that selection will jump around in the dialog box, and you can once again tap the space bar to basically click on that button. So if you just hit the tab key once, it'll jump over to that delete file button. You can tap the space bar and it'll activate that button. This is also useful for accessing drop-down lists and things like that, say in an open save dialog box. So you can actually tab over to a drop-down, hit the space bar, it'll open up that drop down, and then you can use your arrow keys to scroll down that menu and again hit the space bar to click on any of the elements to actually activate them. So you can actually navigate around these dialog boxes with keyboard commands. And I hope you find these tips useful, and it'll save you some time when you're going through those delete podcast dialog boxes. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Before I get out of here, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, you can get cash for your old electronic devices. If you want to upgrade that iPad, maybe you want to get rid of that iPad 1 quickly and easily, you can use gazelle.com. Just do a simple search. They'll make you an upfront offer, and you can get cash for your old stuff. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, check out their software and as well as get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. You can find more information on their software as well as get free trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Stitcher, download the free Stitcher Smart Radio application and you can stream and get access to all of your favorite podcasts and radio stations. And right now, new people who sign up using the code MACCAST will be entered into the contest to win a free iPad 2. So find that at Stitcher.com, STITCHER.com/MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. A couple of announcements to let you know about. One, I am in the process of moving the MacCast servers. We are changing my hosting company, and so that is going to be happening sometime this week, probably toward the end of the week. So there might be a couple of disruptions in the website. Specifically, if you're a MacCast member, you need to be aware. I'm expecting things to go as smoothly as possible, but through the DNS change, the site might be offline for brief periods. There might also be some issues in accessing things like the MacCast forum. I'm going to have to offline that to actually move and migrate over the database so that none of the data gets out of sync or anything like that. So there could be some outages. Just be aware of that. But I expect that to go pretty quickly, and we should be back up and running before the weekend, because actually, on Sunday, I'm leaving to go on vacation. I have my yearly camping trip that I take every year. I'm going to be gone for a week, so I'm not sure if you'll have a MacCast the first week in June. I did record a show that I probably will put out on the feed early in the week. That's probably going to be your show for that week. I know that WWDC is going on. I might try and squeeze something in while I'm on my vacation, but no promises there. If not, there'll definitely be a show right when I get back. So please make note of that and plan accordingly, and I appreciate you understanding on that one. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, any questions, anything you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please feel free to send your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the voicemail line. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can leave a voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And if you do leave a voicemail, if you could please leave your email address and spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. That way, if I have any follow-up questions or need to get back to you, I have a way to do that. Otherwise, I have no idea how to respond to you, and I can't cover everything on the show, so I might be able to answer your question even if it doesn't end up on an episode of the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those at maccast.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or over on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you can keep up to date with everything that I'm doing between shows if you really want to. And I think that about covers it. So that's going to do it for today. I don't have new music for you today. I didn't have time to do that, and we're actually running a bit long. So I think we're going to skip that this time. So until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.